this new threat to dissent. Thursday, July 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Indie Media Space, Barrios Unidos, 1817 Soquel Avenue. Collectively, Indie Media activists and friends shot hundreds of hours of video footage documenting the FTAA protests in Miami. This footage has been edited by the FTAA Miami Video Working Group into a documentary that cuts through the mass media blackout to reveal the brutal repression and assault on civil liberties that took place, as well as the life-affirming and inspiring alternatives to capitalist globalization that were also in full effect in Miami.
Interrumpir las negociaciones, bloqueo de rutas de acceso a la ciudad.
No salario.
Bloqueo de rutas de acceso a la ciudad de Miami.
That's the Miami model, Free Trade Police State, Thursday, July 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Indie Media Space, Barrios Unidos, 1817 Soquel Avenue.
El modelo para la conformación del Área de Libre Comercio de las Américas proviene del Tratado de Libre Comercio de América del Norte, el famoso NAFTA inglés o TLCA español.
El ALCA fue lanzado en 1994.
Desde Alaska hasta Tierra del Fuego.
En la primera cumbre de las Américas.
Protesto contra el ALCA.
No al ALCA.
Resistencia
contra el ALCA.
Expreso rechazo al ALCA.
Difundirlo y denunciarlo, buscando la brecha, haciendo lo que dé lugar que no hay falta.
Reservar las aguas y los ríos de la lógica del lucro, no al ALCA, no a la OMC, no al Imperio Norteamericano.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's your favorite Bathrobe's Beers Broadsides, the hot Thursday evening edition. Stay with us.
I gotta get some toothpaste, and I need vitamin pills. I need to shore up my nutrition and my oral hygiene skills. Let's go shopping at the grocery store. Gotta go grab some goodies we didn't have before. Oh man, I need bananas and I need black beans. I need potassium and a whole lot of protein. Ba 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 da ba 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 ba. At the grocery store, gotta go grab some goodies we didn't have before. Tasty breakfast that will keep my bowels loose. Ba 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 da ba 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 da ba.
Let's go shopping at the grocery store. Gotta go grab some goodies we didn't have before.
Well, if you want to to go shopping at the grocery store, you can do that with Tom Donnelly. That's from Animal Sweet and Sour. Tom is back in the cruise and playing every Wednesday, or we hope, at least he was there yesterday, for SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, the street performers' sing-along, strum-along, sigh-along, scream-along occasionally. Happens every Wednesday at 6 o'clock in front of New Leaf Market, part of the Take Back Public Spaces that's going on downtown. And actually, we had the 25th week of that. There was a special balloons and pie celebration for those of you who were performing. For those of you who weren't, you even got up to lick the bowls and hear the fine music and hang out, which is, yeah, something to be said for that. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. 2 hours of civil rights chatter, chat, call-ins, and the occasional weird musical number. Perhaps not so weird. Anyway, melodic, sometimes in a minor key, sometimes in a more upbeat note. You can provide some of the subtext and some of the text if you call in. The call-in number here is 427-3772. You can also reach us at rnorse3 at hotmail.com on the email line, rnorse3 at hotmail.com. Or you can go to www.pagesincolor and jump on board the chat room in case you find the phone lines tied up. You have a disinclination to wait for me to find your email, and you just want to see what's being said about the show as it's being said. So that's the deal, and hope you can become a part of the show, contribute your own thoughts. Particularly interested in problems around police and bureaucratic misconduct, getting stuff out that otherwise people would be reluctant to talk about. Maybe their attorney told them they shouldn't say anything for 5 years, or maybe they're feeling intimidated because the boss might fire them. Sometimes we've got a good reason, but I encourage you to speak up on issues of local oppression and local concern, local abuse, so that others who are feeling alone will realize that they're not, and that you yourself actually may come to a new understanding of that as well. If you want to listen to this show and you don't have a radio, but you're, shall we say, telepathically receiving it perhaps, or perhaps through the fillings in your teeth, you want to get better reception, you can come down to the Borders bookstore. In front of Borders is, on the public sidewalk, a Huff table. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, and there's a table there. You can actually hear the show bebopping away at you, and Tom Belote of Copwatch will give you some pointers on how to keep an eye on those who are keeping an eye on you. Well, that's the beginning of the show. You will provide the middle and the end, and I'll probably be doing some of that too. Let's turn now to a few street interviews, and then we're going to get on to one of the main subjects we'll be discussing today. Will be something that came out in the Good Times, actually. The Good Times ran into one of the emails that Becky Johnson sent on my behalf to Vice Mayor Mike Rotkin about the city's new collusion with the downtown, or actually it's the West Side Business Association, and setting up homeless get-the-fuck-out signs, that is to say, no parking from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. signs, except if you have a big rig over 12,000 pounds and it's a commercial vehicle. These are being put in at the expense of the businesses, but with the collusion and under the legal authority of the city. And we're going to play some of the city council's tape on that and also talk about that issue somewhat. Again, it's all part of the gentrification, move the poor out of sight, give the businesses whatever the fuck they want, and essentially do so kind of behind closed doors, because that's where most of this happened. And I talked about it a little bit on Sunday. Now I'm going to talk about it again, play some more tape about it, and you'll have a chance to talk about it. So stay tuned. Well, it's July 8, 2004. Down the street, the saxophone is wah-wah-wahing out its tune, and it's about 8:50 in the evening. I'm here with Becky Johnson, Tom Belote, and the infamous Gregory, the man with the guitar on his back and the flak jacket on his shoulder. Sir, why aren't you playing that guitar?
Well, quite simply, I don't wish to cut into people's business, to be honest with you.
You mean you have such an elevated opinion of your own performing skills, you think you would drive away business from other, or would you simply drive away business from the entire downtown as they run away from you?
No, people have never actually ran away. They're welcome to. But I have had it happen in other places where if I had attempted to actually perform and threw down my case or display device, as they say around here, seeking donations, basically I'd have acted like a vacuum in a funnel, like a Walmart, and sucked in all the funds. And I figured I'd be doing to the detriment of all the other efforts of the
So it is simply
artist.
For the general good that you're not unloosing your magical guitar.
Basically, yes. I do play on this outdoors here, but only generally as part of a group. And that's about it. I have not attempted to be a Mr. Soloist here. And I thought it was better that way. Although, I fancied myself, if I did seem to collect more than a generous share, I would then distribute it. Just say, here.
Communist.
Yeah.
I noticed the saxophone player is playing down there. We heard one musician comment, don't support the saxophonist. He's driving people out of business. I guess we walk up there and catch an earful of his music. I'm going to go do that and find out if this, in fact, is the case. So we're approaching Walnut and Pacific here. On the corner, we hear the illegal sounds of saxophonists playing. Is it amplified music?
Yeah.
Without a permit?
Yeah.
This is shocking. I may have to contribute to this. East meets West. These are, they have a Boku Bucks in their box. And they are grooving here on the corner, but they are playing with an open display case within 10 feet of a building, a no-no in Scott Kennedy's Santa Cruz. We have a musician, in fact, is the flamenco guitarist himself. Your name, sir?
Ricardito.
Ricardito, you're playing a tune in front of artisans here in beautiful sunny day on Pacific Avenue, Sunday the 11th of July. It's actually about 3:30. How are the pickings, so to speak?
Oh, it's always pretty light here. Play here for the fun of it, not for the money.
You are indeed the gay bandolero with your black hat.
Thank you. El cordobés.
Muy bien. Entonces, toca bien.
Thank you.
And then the notorious Jason Pascal, who is seated in front of his purple-clad table with what appears to be a cup of coffee. How's the business going, Jason?
Well, it's not business, Captain. This is a religious organization here, and this is the Reverend's headquarters.
Now, I understand rumor has it that Officer Pam Bachtel has been, shall we say, taking a liking to conversations with you?
Well, yeah, she came over and told me that I was on her personal list, and I asked her what type of list that meant. She said that was for me to, for her to know and for me to find out. And I kind of took that to be a threat, you know. It's sort of like, you know, she would ask, she said, what list are you talking about? She says, you're on my list. And I walked past, and I said, what list are you talking about? And she said, this was
sort of a thing for you, Jason. Have you thought about that?
Well, you know, whatever, man. And then she came back that afternoon and said, I want you to move. You know, I told her, I said, what, you want me? I said, I'm too tired to move, just like Rosa Parks. My family personally fought that shit for too long. My father was a member of CLOB, which is the Coalition of Leadership of Blacks, which were the first armed black people in the South, even before the Black Panthers here in California. And they had some big, looking like a schnauzer, Germanic bitch come up to me and say, move along. You know, that just sounded to me like move to the back of the bus, and I told her we should go stick it.
When did this happen, Jason?
This happened yesterday.
On Saturday the 10th.
Yes, and it happened in the early afternoon as she was walking up the avenue. It was probably about 12:30, 1 o'clock. I don't really remember the time. I should have written that down. But then I called the police, and they sent Butch Baker down here, who's, he's corrupt. The whole thing is corrupt. They wouldn't take a report. I wanted to file a written complaint, you know. They wouldn't do it. They told me I had to go down to the police department, and I don't trust them. They are very crooked. They had me extradited over marijuana charges. Now, this is a city where they hand out marijuana on the city hall steps, yet I was extradited 3,000 miles to deal with a 4 months in jail over a marijuana sales issue from 1992. Santa Cruz Police Department. They personally ensured that I was moved to New Hampshire. They didn't even want to come pick me up for years. You know?
I remember, in fact, it might have been Sergeant Baker's individual intervention.
That's right. It was Sergeant Baker, Sergeant Lauren Baker, who had me extradited. He also had me arrested and brought to jail for illegally using a milk crate. Yeah, it's like, you know, ripping the tag off.
Humping the milk crate? What kind of behavior you engaged in?
I was sitting on the milk crate.
Oh, abusing the milk crate through sitting. Well, no wonder. Don't you know there is a statute in this state against milk crate abuse?
Well, you know, there's also a law that says, you know, you're going to get serious penalties if you tear the tag off your mattress.
Well, now, you're back here. You've been back on the mall for, what, 6 months now?
Yes.
And Baker, he's not the sergeant downtown. How did he happen to show up? Because you made a complaint about that?
Yeah, I called 911, you know, and told them that I was being harassed and targeted by the police, in which I was told I was going to be targeted. And in this day of age where they got this national security, all this homeland security stuff, but she says that I'm on her list. You know, and here the city says that we're not going to work and we're not going to give the names to the national security people, yet they go and have people, they call other states, you know, and work against the local majority who voted to have marijuana legalized for medical patients. I'm a medical patient and they had me extradited over a medical marijuana charge. You know, yet they handed out and break federal law, you know, at the city hall. You know, that's okay. That's all right. They can do that. You know, that's okay. They can do whatever the fuck
they
want.
What you're doing, I notice you have a tape recorder. Well, I'm here with a woman who is doing some, what do we call this, flower cutting? What's the word on this?
And before we get into the flower cutting, a comment quickly about Jason Pascal, also known as the Reverend Doctor. You may have seen him. He reads cards and gives a kind of a spiritual analysis of your aura and or whatever. Never quite understood exactly what he does. He's down near the gelato shop at Pacific and the Church Street, I think it is. And in any case, it's this was like several weeks ago. This cut is from, and more recently, he's been doing pretty good. He has not been arrested or cited, which it's not so much that I point myself the personal protector of every particular fortune teller on the street, if you will, even every African-American fortune teller. Jason's African-American, but he did suffer a lot of harassment and abuse several years ago when he was here. He is accurate in saying he was deported for use of marijuana, and it was a vendetta campaign, it seemed like to me, pursued by Sergeant Lauren, also known as Butchie Baker. And in a time when we have no writ of habeas corpus anymore in this country, in case you haven't noticed, that was removed by the Hamdi and Padilla decisions. The Supreme Court essentially said you don't really have the right to get to an attorney and to a court if you're declared an enemy noncombatant, and that's completely a matter of presidential discretion. But you, they will take you maybe before some neutral authority somewhere, and then you have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that you're innocent. That's really where we're at, folks. There's no more writ of habeas corpus, which is the fundamental protection that we got back in with the Magna Carta times, when at least the nobles were able to secure with respect to the king the assurance that they would not be held in a dungeon somewhere without having the right to go to a court and have being told the charges against them. That is no longer the right of American citizens. And under the Patriot Act, of course, thousands upon thousands of human beings who don't have citizenship have been subjected to this process. They've been held, they've been detained for days, weeks, months, years, yes, years, on no charges, and then either deported, released, or continue to be held. That's the United States of America in which you are currently residing that is doing that right now. So I'm concerned about local abuses around these matters. Whenever this happens, you might say, oh, that's just President Bush. You know, I mean, President Kerry, Mayor Scott Kennedy. No one here would ever do such a thing. No. Once the precedent is set at the highest level, it filters down very quickly to police departments everywhere that they have that kind of power. And this is something that we're going to have to fight on a local level. I don't know whether we have to fight street to street or through peaceful protest or through boycotts or whatever means we can. But that is what we're in the middle of right now. We're in the middle of a proto-fascist period. Fascism, that is to say, the withdrawal of the writ of habeas corpus, without Congress, by the way, suspending it. So it's an unconstitutional withdrawal of the writ of habeas corpus. Congress has the right to suspend the writ of habeas corpus in times of war or insurrection, but that wasn't done. Congress never suspended the writ of habeas corpus. This was done presidentially, and this was done sort of around the bend by passing things like the Patriot Act, which didn't declare it was suspending that aspect of the Constitution. It simply gave these huge powers to the federal government, even though we are at war with no country. It's the war on terror, folks. It's terror, actually, raging war on us. It's not Al-Qaeda who is detaining thousands of people, I want to point out. It's your own government that's doing that. So I'm going to be talking more about those issues. And again, locally, I see a similar kind of repression in a small kind of way. We see, you know, the police and the city council restricting and cracking down on spaces that poor people can use. We see local courts essentially rubber stamping First Amendment violations that are pretty obvious, like the right to draw a peace symbol on the sidewalk with erasable chalk has been declared defacement, hence illegal, hence subject to, you can be arrested, held in jail, your bail upped, as happened to activist Becky Johnson. I talked about all this before, and I'll be talking about it again. We got city council races coming up, and as of this morning, the fine selection of people you're going to have in November to vote for the Santa Cruz City Council includes Premack, Kennedy, Riley, Porter, Ryan Coonerty, that's Bookshop Santa Cruz, and former mayor Neil Coonerty's son, Tony Madrigal, and I think it's Arno Giacchini. I apologize in advance. I have that name pronounced wrong, but I think he was the third or fourth runner-up in the last election. So you've got the four recycled candidates, Premack, Kennedy, Riley, and Porter running. You have and then you have these other three. Obviously, none of these, unfortunately, are candidates I can endorse in terms of their supporting any kind of program that would return rights that have been taken away in this town or lead us in a direction that I think the majority of the town wants to go in terms of more open public spaces, kind of coming into the 21st century. So we end things like the drug war. We stop using police for functions that have to do with going after poor people, but use them instead if necessary to deal with really violent crime, deal with housing issues. All these things are not really on the agenda. And, of course, the pretext locally for that is the budget. And, of course, the budget is to a large extent because of the war. This isn't Bush's war, by the way. This is the war that the Democrats also gave us. I know they're going to tell you, oh, we did so because we were misinformed. You know, we didn't know. Well, I'm going to read a story here. Story from Counterpunch called Banking on Your Desperation, the Bush-Kerry War Ticket. This is from counterpunch.org and by Stan Cox. And it's got a lot of interesting documentation. I encourage you to go to the www.counterpunch.org website and check it out. Like tens of millions of American voters, I am desperate to see President Bush out of the White House. But I'm not voting for John Kerry. I'm not that desperate. When it comes to the centerpiece of the Bush presidency, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, Kerry is taking a more belligerent line than even Bush himself. On July 16th, he told the Wall Street Journal that he would be less likely than Bush to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq anytime soon. I'll be reading that story in a moment. And that if he was elected, the occupation would continue at least through his first term in office. That's Kerry talking, not Bush. When asked how many additional troops should be deployed in Iraq, Kerry said that once in office, he would sit with the generals and discuss the size of the increase. Earlier, he had told Defense News that he would add two divisions to the current 10-division army, an increase of 40,000 troops, while continuing research and development of the Star Wars missile defense corporate welfare system, and not surprisingly, raising the overall military budget. At a press conference also on June 16th, Kerry endorsed the two most controversial elements of Bush's foreign policy, first strike war and unilateralism. He asked, "Am I prepared to go get them before they get us if we locate them and have sufficient intelligence?" And answered, "You bet I am." He later added, still in the classic Bush mode, "I will never allow any other country to veto what we need to do, and I will never allow any other institution to veto what we need to do to protect our nation." The Kerry team has even managed to banish criticism of the Iraq war from the Democratic Party's 2004 platform. They forced the backers of anti-war challenger Dennis Kucinich to accept instead the statement that, quote, "People of goodwill disagree about whether America should have gone to war in Iraq." In moving closer to and in some cases beyond Bush's policies, Kerry is ignoring his own party's rank and file. A recent New York Times CBS poll found 56% of the Democrats agreeing that our troops should leave Iraq as soon as possible, even if Iraq is not completely stable, while only 38% believe we should stay in Iraq as long as it takes to make sure Iraq is a stable democracy. The Kerry Democrats' refusal to criticize the war in their party platform is puzzling, since the polls over the past month have shown that a majority of Americans believe we should never have invaded Iraq, and that fully 60% believe we should not attack another country unless it attacks first. John Kerry has given me no choice but to vote against both him and Bush. In doing so, I refuse to be charged with single-issue voting. The presidential candidate who insists on a long-term occupation of Iraq is saying that he is not serious about curing our addiction to Middle Eastern oil or development of renewable energy. The candidate who is willing to spend billions of dollars on Iraq, and he is hinting on other wars, in each and every month of his presidency is not serious about reducing the Bush budget deficits or about addressing domestic crises in health, education, and the environment. A candidate who won't discuss a timetable for ending America's military occupation of Arab lands is hardly going to stop supporting Israel's occupation forces and settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, and Kerry's positions have become almost indistinguishable from Bush's on that issue as well. And as a candidate who wants to continue sending the sons and daughters of working people to fight a war for, in his words, Iraq's, quote, stability and security, pointedly leaving out Bush's rhetoric about democracy, is less interested in the lives of people than in the profits of corporations. Across the country, as always, good Democratic candidates can be found at the local, state, and congressional levels. Please show them to me. I want to see them. But at the top of the ticket, as always, there's a timid fellow struggling to get as little to let as little daylight as possible pass between him and his Republican opponent. Voting dutifully against Reagan, against Bush 1, against Dole, and against Bush 2 over the past two decades has not brought us better Democratic candidates, only worse Republicans. Now we see close to 900 American troops dead in Iraq, with more than 5,000 maimed. At least 11,000 Iraqi civilians have died so far, and their country is in chaos. All the rationales for having invaded Iraq lie in shambles. Despite it all, John Kerry is unwilling to condemn this mad adventure. In fact, he's telling us that he's thirsty for more. He thinks I'm desperate enough to vote for him anyway, but he's wrong. That's by Stan Cox. He's a plant breeder and writer living in Salina, Kansas. He can be reached at t.s@cox.net in case you want to chat with him about this. And it's from the Counterpunch website. The article is termed "Banking on Your Desperation, the Bush-Kerry War Ticket." Now, this story, which is on the Counterpunch website, quotes a number of other stories which I found interesting. I'm going to read some of them. He makes some claims that some people may find surprising. I know when I was walking up and down Pacific Avenue yesterday, I ran into a fleet of young Democratic Party apparatchiks with little clipboards, registering voters at ironing boards, and just generally saying, hey, you want to defeat Bush? Want to defeat Bush? Are you against Bush? You know, vote for the Democrats here. And when I asked them, are you aware that Kerry favors 40,000 more troops for Iraq? Not a single one of them was aware of that. So it's begun to occur to me that people aren't even aware of Kerry's positions on this issue, and they may not believe what I'm reading. It's some left-wing propaganda, some pro-Nader nonsense, though Nader himself has not called for an immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, as I and others have had his first term. Quote, At the end of my first term, I would consider it a failure of my diplomacy if we haven't reduced the numbers significantly, Mr. Kerry said, but I certainly can't tell you numbers. The key at this point is to have a stable, non-failed state that is moving toward democracy and has security sufficient for the government to stand on its own. Kerry senior foreign policy advisor James P. The three-part test the candidate articulated was more specific than his previous admonitions that American troops couldn't leave Iraq until Iraq had become more stable and secure. Mr. Rubin noted that some portion of the U.S. troop deployment might be able to return home as Iraq moves closer to meeting Mr. But Mr. Kerry declined to spell out the benchmarks that he would use to measure conditions in Iraq or specify any incremental troop reductions along the way. I have a plan how we can get there, quote-unquote, by enlisting greater international support, Mr. Kerry said, aboard his campaign plane. I'm not going to negotiate my plan on the newspapers, but I'll get there in ways that this president can't because he has burned the bridges of credibility and burned the alliances. They need to be reestablished with a new president. The issue of Iraq has posed a challenge for Mr. Kerry throughout his campaign. In the fall of 2002, he voted a majority to give President Bush authority to go to war to remove Saddam Hussein. Later, war opponent Howard Dean shot to the front of the Democratic nomination race. Kerry was thrown on the defensive and criticized Bush for misusing the authority he obtained to use force. Late last year, Kerry voted against legislation to satisfy the president's request for an additional $87 billion in war-related spending, a vote that Mr. Bush and his campaign have harshly criticized in recent days. And I'm going to add, just looking at the story, that Kerry voted in favor of the entire largest military budget in U.S. history about 2 weeks ago, along with our great representative, Sam Farr. But as he prepares for a convention that his campaign wants to use to introduce him more fully to the American public, Mr. Kerry is determined to present himself as a leader of strength, one who would more effectively pursue the same goals Mr. Bush has established for progress in Iraq and the broader anti-terror war. Instead of acting promptly to reduce troop strength, he said he would consult with military commanders to determine how many more troops might be needed in the near term to safeguard Iraq. I know how to do that, said Mr. Kerry, a Vietnam veteran who has previously accused the president of insufficiently taking the needs of U.S. troops into account. I think I'll do that more effectively than this president, and I'll listen to them with greater respect than this president and this Secretary of Defense did. As that before or after he sends them off to kill and be killed in Iraq. I suppose maybe it's both before and after. Derided by the Bush team as a flip-flopping legislator, he made the same charge about shifts in the president's position following the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, among other setbacks. I don't trust this administration's definition of where they're going or what they're going to do, he said. They've already shifted everything. They've shifted the reason for the war. They're capable of shifting anything. Well, I got to tell you, Kerry sounds pretty shifty to me. Here is Kerry talking with, well, if you want to get the specific verbatim transcript of Kerry talking with Wall Street Journal reporters Jacob Schlesinger and John Harwood, you can go to the Counterpunch website, and it's again an addenda to this article, which I read you by Stan Cox. It's easy to find. It's pretty much at the top of the list of articles there. And here's another article, What If John Kerry Wins, by William Matthews from DefenseNews.com. If John Kerry becomes U.S. president, defense budgets will keep going up, he says, but how is that money, how that money is spent is going to change. Budgets have to keep rising for a period, unavoidably, the Democratic presidential hopeful said in a June 24th interview with Defense News. The war in Iraq, the global war on terrorism, military transformation, and the need to repair and replace weapons lost or simply worn down in Iraq make higher defense budgets inevitable, Kerry said. But Kerry also said he is willing to delay missile defense plans and cut back other weapons programs to add two divisions to the 10-division army. President George W. Bush has made deploying a missile intercept system a top military priority and plans to spend $9.2 billion on it in 2005 alone. Kerry says that's spending too much too soon. I'm not for the rapid deployment of missile defense, the Massachusetts senator said. I'm for research and deployment and continuing the testing, but I don't think we're ready for deployment. I think that's a pool of money that's going to be wasted. Cuts to the missile defense program could yield several billion dollars to be spent on other defense needs. I won't tell you how many billion have been spent on the Iraqi war, except you can read in the papers daily that there's a retrenchment almost every week in terms of National Guard units, lengths of time being extended, army quotas being fudged. It's They're having trouble balancing the books over there as it is, thanks to votes from people like Senator John Kerry. Kerry declined to specify what other programs might also be cut, saying he would order a threat analysis to indicate which systems now in development are no longer top priorities, he said. What I'm committed to is transformation of the military for the 21st century, he said, a force that is able to fight terrorism and also able to handle more traditional threats. I think having a more mobile, more special operations-oriented, more flexible, rapidly deployable military is very important to us. Kerry said there is a general need to modernize weapons, develop newer systems for urban warfare, and repair or replace older weapons and equipment worn out in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those would be budget priorities. At least as pressing as the need to add troops to the overburdened U.S. Army. Of the two divisions Kerry proposes to add, about 40,000 troops. One would be a standard combat division, and the other would be a support division designed for post-conflict operations. It would include civil affairs, psychological operations, military police, engineering, and all those kinds of components that are part of winning the post-war effort. We have a phone call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey. Thanks for allowing me to be on Free Radio, Robert. You're doing an awesome show.
Sure.
And I have an announcement that is just such in line with your show today. There's going to be a West Coast video premiere of a film called The Miami Model.
Mm-hmm. 8 o'clock tonight, perhaps?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
About 7:30 we'll get started, so you still got time.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Miami Model, Free Trade Police State. It's about it's a 90-minute documentary about the events that took place in Miami, and it was a fine, fine example of a fascist police state.
Now, wait a minute. Florida is a place where dreams come true, where dreamers come.
If you're a Mickey Mouse.
We dream a lot here, and my dream for our state is we take full advantage of our geography, according to Florida Governor Jeb Bush. You're not suggesting that Jeb's dream is, less than ideal?
I think Jeb is dreaming about exploitation and money.
Huh. I'm looking at an article here in Fault Lines, which is, I guess, an indie media publication here, which was left in the studio. And I guess people can go online to www.ftaaimc.org/Miami Model if they want more details. Or they can come on down to Barrios Unidos. Where is that?
It's at 1817 SoCal Avenue.
Uh-huh.
So if you take SoCal from downtown, it's on your left, just before Capitola Road, after the Safeway by Takara.
Huh. And that's, how long is the film for?
It's 90 minutes.
And is there going to be discussion? Will it be popcorn?
There will be popcorn. There will be...
Will you have a police raid breaking up the film?
I don't know about the police. They're not invited.
It's no fun.
So when we say open invitation, that obviously doesn't mean the police.
I see.
Yeah.
So again, this is 1817 SoCal Avenue. Barrios Unidos starts at... sort of at 7, but maybe you'll kind of push
it. About 7:30.
7:30.
Is the feature presentation.
And there's donation, but no entrance fee?
Right.
Okay.
Suggested donation.
Are you going to exclude Kerry supporters, or are you going to let them in?
They are definitely welcome.
I see.
I was just going to say that they're trying to print 1,000 copies of the video to distribute at the DNC and the RNC, because it's really important that a lot of people watch this material.
Well, here's a
preparation for taking the streets.
Here's a quote. One of the most shocking images in the video is the police assault on Elizabeth Ritter, a Miami lawyer, dressed in a business suit, wearing high heels, and carrying a sign that reads, "Fear another totalitarian administration." She was pelted by rubber bullets and suffered an injury to the head. In the soon-to-be-released DVD of the Miami Model, which includes post-riot interviews, Ritter puts what happens to her in a larger context. Those who participated in the activities against the FTAA in Miami will forever be affected by the experience. The extremity of police repression and the range and sophistication of their tactics left scars on us all. Did you get to Miami yourself?
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
I've got to go. I'm going to go set up Barrios Unidos.
Okay, well, you'll be there for maybe to talk to people afterward if they come?
Yeah, you just reminded me to grab the rubber bullet I got shot with.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
All right, so come check out the rubber bullets at Barrios Unidos.
1817 SoCal Avenue.
These are hard plastic bullets, folks. Don't think that these are comfy.
I remember the rubber bullets from Los Angeles.
All right.
All right.
All right, peace. Thanks.
Hey, take care. So if you're bored with this particular radio show, hey, hustle on down to 1817 SoCal and check out it's described as a pretty graphic film, The Miami Model, which is, of course, what police are doing at protests to stop things like the successful Seattle victory in 1999. They're massing in huge numbers to intimidate protesters from even showing up. And then once they're isolating, demoralizing, and essentially immediately repressing them with huge numbers of police. So check it out. We have to devise strategies to fight that. And if you have any thoughts on this issue, you might want to call in. And plus, of course, I'm reading this story about Kerry's defense policies. That is to say, his war policies. There's no defense that's really being discussed here. There's a huge military all over the world, which is causing all kinds of people, nut jobs and non-nut jobs, to fight back. And that's what we're faced with. And of course, that's being used as a pretext by the military and aggressive right-wing and democratic centrist politicians to justify even more military buildup and intervention. It's a deadly spiral, an endless circle. But let me know what you think, 427-3772. This is Robert Norse on Bathrop Spears Broadsides. You can also email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, or you can wander over to the chat room at pagesincolor.com and chat. Right now you'll be chatting with yourself, but who knows? If more people call in, you can chat with others. And you can even chat with Free Radio. So we've got, we're all ready to chat and chatter if you want to chat. Let's have a little musical break while we, I don't know, wait for the next goodness knows what. Stay with us.
Thought I'd stop by. Hands folded quietly behind my back. I hope you don't mind if I lack the knack to make artful conversation, but a natural infatuation makes my heart rush, me blood gush, my face blush. Red as a rash, blundering bashfully through every word, I try to be casual, but I sound absurd when I say any phrase that occurs. Then I nervously raise my face, and you smile politely, but blankly.
Tough to take that kind of music, but I'm counting on you, Free Radio audience. You can deal with it. If anyone else can, if anyone can, you can. So I may lighten up on you, though, at the next musical break. That's getting a little heavy even for me. Well, I really was going into, in some detail, the Kerry war program. And I think it's not because I don't want to see Bush out. But I think we need to see the primary objective has to be policy change. It can't be a change in the personnel, unless that's going to cause a policy change. Otherwise, you're just pushing in the wrong direction. So certainly make that decision in November as to who you're going to vote for. But before that happens, when I see Democratic Party people on the street doing the happy thing, doing the let's all get Bush out thing, without paying any concern as to what kind of additional troops Kerry is going to send to Iraq, what kind of additional funding he's going to give to the war budget, what kind of, well, I've already read kind of in detail the specifics that he's already proposed, his plan to sit down with the generals, his absurd plan that he wants stability and a country that will not fail when it's quite clear there's a massive insurgency and we have a puppet government set up there. I think we have to support not necessarily this person or that person. We have to demand that whoever is in power make the policy changes that will bring people home now. And in Santa Cruz, the same thing has to be done. I think we need to insist our local politicians take a stand on this insofar as they claim to be progressives. I think we need to be out there demonstrating in ways that we were a year and a half ago, or possibly, I'm sure, in new creative ways. And in line with that objective, HUF, the organization I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, though we don't have the person power to do much sustained vigiling ourselves, are calling for all peace groups to unite and reestablish the vigil against two wars that began on a 24-hour basis way back in March of 2003. That was at the corner of Cooper and Pacific, you may remember. It was right there across from the Cinema 9. It went on there for a week, and then it continued for, some say for as much as 40 days, moving around to the town clock, moving to different places under the leadership of Olivia Brown Rabbit and others. And, you know, it's interesting. The respectable peace activists, though I guess some of them gave sort of some quiet support to this vigil, weren't really there kind of at the middle of it. They... you know, they came out for the Peace Fridays, you know. They came out for the huge marches and then went home again. And, I mean, no doubt, that I'm not saying that people of sincere goodwill aren't trying in their own way to fight, to organize. Fighting is the wrong word, perhaps, to use about this if you're pacifistically oriented, or if you're oriented towards, you want to look at it as peaceful protest. But it is a struggle. People are doing this kind of thing, but I think it needs to be done visibly. And I think the more it's done visibly, the more it gives heart to people who feel that nothing can be done. I mean, we tend to think nothing can be done except register more people for a candidate, John Kerry, who wants to send more people over to Iraq and is prepared to continue the war throughout his first term and further, and who has made no commitment to any kind of reduction in any kind of troop strength. In fact, he's talking about sending more troops and is criticizing the Bush regime, suggesting they're going to try an October surprise that will be not a terrorist attack that will bring everybody, you know, round everybody up to the concentration camps, but a withdrawal of troops from Iraq to persuade the country that they're really the peace group. That's what Kerry claims the Bush administration wants to do. I don't think the Bush administration wants to do that, but I think it shows what Kerry's values and priorities are, or else what his cynical assessment of what's required to win this election is. And I think in either case, you need to assert again and again, and you have to struggle and work for bringing people home now so they can stop the killing and stop the dying. And I'm going to keep babbling about that, I think, for quite a while. Hopefully I won't have to babble about it for too long, but it looks like a long babble ahead. Around the issue of the Democratic Party platform, Kerry team settles dispute with Kucinich delegates over Iraq, New York Times. Senator John Kerry's reps avoided a Democratic Party platform fight over Iraq on Saturday, this was July 10th, by persuading platform committee delegates supporting Representative Dennis Kucinich to withdraw their proposals for a quick withdrawal of U.S. combat troops from Iraq. Instead, the committee agreed to present a platform to the Democratic Convention in Boston this month that reflects Mr. Kerry's position. That's that brave and bold Dennis Kucinich. Remember the one that was the great hope for the future? The statement of party principles promises to seek help from Western allies and Arab countries in bringing Iraq under control, but says nothing about how to accomplish that goal. The critical paragraph was worked out in negotiations between Mr. Kucinich's delegates and Mr. Kerry's supporters, led by Samuel R. Berger, who was President Bill Clinton's national security advisor. It pledges to remove American troops, quote, when appropriate, so that the military support needed by a sovereign Iraqi government will no longer be seen as the direct continuation of an American military presence. Amazingly cynical kind of assessment, and also, in its own ways, completely unrealistic. There is no sovereign Iraqi government. There is a bunch of Iraqi-appointed former CIA workers, at least one, the one who heads the government, Alawi, is. who are essentially being assassinated one after another by an insurgent movement in Iraq. So what does the U.S. propose to do under Kerry? What does Kerry and this Democratic Party hack Samuel Berger propose? They propose American troops will be removed when appropriate so that the American military support needed by a sovereign Iraqi government will no longer be seen as a direct continuation of American military presence. So maybe they want to move in camouflage troops disguised as defense contractors. What's happening there, of course, is the support troops supposedly to be built using the support, not troops, but the support security forces and reconstruction people that are being paid huge sums to fundamentally privatize the war in Iraq are being kidnapped and some of them killed in order to let the American and, I should say, the American allied group, it's mainly American and British, it's hardly anybody else there, know that they're going to get out or they're going to get dead. Which, I don't think much of Islamic fundamentalists. I don't know what I think of particular groups, the Sunni or Shia groups fighting, but I can understand groups fighting for sovereignty in their own country. That's pretty clear. And I'll use this metaphor again. There may be plenty of people against Bush, but if the French and British invaded the U.S. to remove Bush, I don't think any of us would support French and British occupation. And if they stayed around, I think you'd find yourselves rebelling against them in the most direct way, violently and otherwise. So it's not a great mystery what's going on over there. What's a mystery is why American people continue to buy all this bullshit as it gets larded out by the heads of the Democratic and Republican parties. Anyhow, I'm going to be trying to give little lessons to Democratic Party signature bearers who are around, and I'm also going to try to give you a few interesting articles I found here, which are kind of depressing, but worth considering. I mean, some of them are pretty obvious. New attacks add to pressure on oil prices. Oil prices were last night, as of Monday, actually, edging toward a 20-year high as strong speculative demand in the wake of fresh terrorist attacks in Iraq left the cost of crude trading at about $41 a barrel in New York. Despite the pledge by the OPEC cartel to pump more oil onto the global market, prices of U.S. light crude were up about 25 cents to $41.50, just short of the $42.45 reached in early June. Oil prices are still strong because demand is strong, capacity utilization is high, we've still got concerns over security of supply. I love it. Yeah, with the pipelines being blown up every day, I would imagine you have concerns. Here's an article, Iraq is not improving, it's a disaster. This is by Oliver Miles in The Guardian. July 20th, the Commons debate, that's in the British Parliament, on Iraq today is a historic opportunity for Parliament. British policy in Iraq is at a turning point, and we can exercise a vital degree of influence on U.S. policy as well. Earlier in the summer, there were some welcome international developments. One was the Security Council resolution of June 8th, endorsing the formation of a sovereign interim government, which did something to heal the rifts created in 2003. Another was the, I don't agree with this, but that's fine. Another was the successful low-key handover of authority. And then again, I don't agree with that either. But the impression that the situation in Iraq itself is much improved is down to Iraq fatigue in the media. The security situation is calamitous. Two recent attacks killed 9 U.S. Marines. The attack on the Iraqi Minister of Justice killed 5 bodyguards. Bombings and attacks on Iraqi security forces have caused multiple deaths. Targets in Fallujah have been bombed by the U.S. Air Force repeatedly, I might add. Foreigners have been kidnapped or executed with the aim of driving foreign troops and foreign companies out of Iraq. This, however, is the tip of the iceberg. Attacks on U.S. troops are running at dozens a day, frequently accompanied by looting, burning, and stoning. It is generally believed in Baghdad that around 1,000 Iraqis leave the country every day for Jordan and Syria because the security situation is intolerable. According to the Iraqi media, gunmen have killed 6 Baghdad local councilors in the last 2 weeks and roughly 750 in the last year. Friends of the Americans such as Ahmad Shalabi are discredited. Enemies such as the young Shia firebrand Muqtada al-Sadr have their tails up. And actually, then there's a lot of talk about local British politics.
and some discussion of British media. Let's take a more melodic musical break, and when I come back, we'll turn more to local issues and to whatever you got on your minds. 427-3772.
Now the Israelis have a nudist camp on Taba, right by Egypt on the Gulf of Aqaba. Bathers sunning on the beach were dangerously within reach of Muslim guards patrolling near the spot. And now it says to cover up in the Koran, but those Hebrews hung it out to get a tan. So for fear of getting heated, the Egyptians just retreated, which provoked this novel thought for a peace plan. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. No need to hurl a rock across the fence if your enemy is being real attentive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get more room if you disrobe. Relations will improve around the globe. Now the colonel of the Egyptian police platoon made this comment as he peered beyond the dune. All these sabras on the Sinai really look a sight to mine eye, though I think we'd better take some action soon. As he turned, he saw the men of his fine crew, field glasses trained on each attractive Jew. So he went and gave the order to redefine the border 100 yards down farther from the view. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. You can unveil a devastating offensive. It's healthier than war and less expensive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get more room if you disrobe. Relations will improve around the globe. Now here's the surest way to end a running feud. Simply approach your adversary in the nude. If he or she's approved, they'll think it's lewd and move away. Who knows, they might be in the mood. You win either way. So if you're fighting and you just can't take it, you just might try your luck at standing naked. Before they have another riot, Northern Ireland should try it. The whole world could ease its tensions if we'd only undertake it. I propose this brand new cure for hot disputes. Have the warring parties meet in birthday suits. Imagine how a summit conference might progress. Formalities abandoned as each delegate undressed. No harm in getting back to bare essentials. World leaders must admit it has potential. For uncovered, one can make appeals to what the other side reveals and see they're not so different after all. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. No need to hurl a rock across the fence if your enemy is being real attentive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get results if you disrobe. Relations can improve around the globe. Oh, yes, indeed. Relations will improve all over the globe.
And that's Mark Levy, of course. Take Off Your Clothes from the album of the same name. And you actually have a seemingly naked Mark Levy on the cover of this album. He puts it out from Nuclear Records in Felton. That's not nuclear, but that's New Clear Records. If you give him a call up at 338-7283, you can get a copy of this. He needs the money, and I think the song is great, and so are his other songs. Kind of old, but still good. Well, it's 7 o'clock, and actually this is, if you have a cable TV, you want to make a brief announcement that there's a community TV show, and you might want to look at, that's Club Cruise. This program's producer, Becky Johnson, also does Club Cruise, and she did a show that's being replayed on Club Cruise involving an interview with Jane Kaiser. That's Jane Kaiser of PERC, Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective, group concerned with stopping forced incarceration, forced shocking, forced drugging, and the whole wild and crazy, mad model. So that's at 7 o'clock on Channel 27, if you want to check it out. And coming up next week at the same time, on Thursday at 7, also at Tuesday at 7, you can pick up on what I'm going to be talking about now very shortly, which is the latest attack on homeless people by the city council and the downtown businesses. It's actually, the main attack is not by the council. The attack is by businesses in collusion with city government through the Public Works Department and the no parking signs stuff that some of you may read about in the Sentinel. Dan White wrote about it the other day, strangely enough. It should be a tip of the hat to Dan, who actually did a story that was of some interest. I think it was on Monday. I'll be getting into that story. And I'm going to be playing for you the actual debate at City Council on this issue. And it's kind of self-explanatory. It has to do with essentially criminalizing parking at night between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., posting signs on a number of streets, 11, 12 streets, which are non-residential areas, but which some folks have been parking their vans on. Now, there's currently a law that says you can't park for more than 72 hours, or that's called considered vehicle storage, and your van can be towed. And some streets have been posted with no parking, parking for only 12 hours. And then there's permit parking, which lets you park only for 2 hours. But this is no parking, and you don't get to park at all. And, you know, it's we've heard various excuses for permit parking. Oh, well, you know, there's a massive inflow of students, so we want to save residents' right to park in front of their own homes. It's sort of a plausibility to that. Sure, why not? Except that as part of permit parking, they've included proposals that allow banning of all non-permit parking between midnight and 6. And that is obviously, it seems pretty clearly, an anti-homeless measure designed to go after people who either live in their vehicles or who live in their vehicles and sleep in them, or live in their vehicles and then go off into the bushes to hide, or maybe go into somebody's couch to couch surf, who haven't got the resources, that is, to actually have to own a house or to rent $80 a night motel rooms. That's how much it was. I checked the other night, the cheap motel, the former Inn Cal, I don't know what they call it now, at the corner of Ocean and Broadway. Anyway, here's the city council meeting from, I guess it's late June, which, I guess late June, let me double check. No, actually it's July, July 13th. This is a city council meeting in which Kennedy kind of returned to his old tricks. He took all the items that activists removed from the council agenda because they wanted to talk about them and put them many hours ahead so that if we wanted to talk about them, we would have to not only wait many, many hours, but we wouldn't know when the items would be coming on. So in essence, he cut off our speech on those items. But he did allow discussion on one item. And interestingly enough, that was an item that we also wanted to talk on, and that was this parking sign, no parking signs. And again, it's not just midnight to 6, which is what the permit parking allows, but it's 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., which is a special additional period of forbidden zone, public zone removal, which is being pushed by the West Side businesses and the West Side Alliance of Businesses and funded by them. That's what's so interesting. So let's listen to the city council discussion. If you have eaten recently, have a little doggy bag nearby just in case you feel ill. But unfortunately, this is what we are confronted with, and this is what we got to deal with, so stay tuned.
This is a public works item calling for no parking signs in the Westside Industrial Area. It's a budget adjustment. The recommendation before the City Council is that the City Council adopt a resolution transferring funds and amending the budget in the amount of $12,000. This action is required in order to accept funds from the Westside Alliance Merchants to fund the installation of no parking signs in the Westside Industrial Area on a series of about a dozen streets that are mentioned in the agenda that I won't read in the public record here. And we have at least four members of the public who wish to speak to this item. If you'd line up on the right-hand side, and I believe, Ms. Johnson, this is one of your items, please come forward.
Hi, I'm Becky Johnson, and you did we did send you a written response on this item, which you may or may not have read. So you're having troubles with litter, camping, and storage of vehicles on some of the streets in the west side, the weedy industrial side of town. So, well, why don't you put up signs that provide an effective separation wall between long-distance truckers who are littering, camping, and storing their vehicles on the property, and people whose only shelter is their vehicle. It's kind of a de facto economic apartheid, if you will. While only a few people are actually causing the kinds of troubles, erecting these signs will collectively punish all who choose to use this area. Then people, especially the people who are barely eking out an existence as it is. How many homeless refugees will your militant police department drive from the land that has been their refuge throughout the history of Santa Cruz? Well, Mayor Scott has driven homeless people from their refuge before. Remember December 1995? Of course, a law which makes it illegal to sleep at night from 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. anywhere outdoors or in a vehicle, anywhere on public property, that's just not enough of a human rights abuse. No, you have to put up signs that will prevent people from being there at all from between, what is it, no parking from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., unless you are a vehicle that weighs 12,000 pounds or more. Now you and the West Side Business Alliance, the police, Matt Farrell, and all the rest are ready to ban an unknown number of people. You must not go forward until you can say for certain where the people you will surely be displacing will go. They need to have someplace safe and legal to go. Perhaps the parking lot at the Emmeline County building. The services out there, there are a lot of parking lots. A nighttime parking space there would work. Or a homeless campground. Someplace where they can go. These are 10 or 12 streets that you're going to be driving people away who are there. Where are they going to go? Not into thin air.
Mr. Norris?
Interrupting briefly, Kennedy is now claiming to dictate the order of who speaks. And this is interesting because he first called Becky Johnson, then he called me. Normally people line up and they choose their own order in speaking. But he seemed to be pressing to have the two of us speak first because the last two speakers are supporters of the signage. They are kind of notorious because they're the Overbecks, and you'll be hearing them in a moment. But they were notorious for slinging numbers of emails attacking the idea of safe sleeping zones that were proposed 4 years ago when Keith Sugar was mayor and were actually a serious proposal on the city council agenda at a time when Catherine Byers was first committed to them and then turned tail and ran and betrayed her constituency by doing that and essentially leaving 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people with no legal place to sleep. But the Overbecks, apparently, are being positioned so that they will be allowed to speak last, and they will not be criticized or contradicted. Could be I'm being a little paranoid here, but that's my interpretation of Kennedy's unusual ordering. Normally, Kennedy does not call on people and tell them to speak if and when. But in this situation, he seemed to be doing that.
Robert Norris, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Yeah, we were of course told by Councilmember Porter about a year and a half ago when we raised the concern about these same kinds of signs being posted all over the city under the permit parking program, that this would be an opportunity for the homeless to get some sort of vehicular housing somewhere else. Well, I guess this is another opportunity that the city council is allowing to slip through on the consent agenda with, I want to point out, no input from homeless service providers that I have been able to determine. I talked to Ken Cole this morning. He hasn't been informed of this issue. And in fact, he hasn't been informed of any no parking issues in the last 2 years since Emily Riley's ill-fated but successful Get Out of Harvey West, again funded by the Business Association out there. This is a business association motivated project. Doesn't mean everything they propose is wrong. However, the homeless people affected by this and the services that you pay to provide services for them have a right, and you have an obligation to contact those services and get their input before passing it on the consent agenda. You should also allow something more of a public process that actually informs people, and I don't just mean the businesses out there, but the community as to what is going on. That's a concern of mine. This is happening in a context where police are driving people away from vehicles all over the city, where 72-hour parking limits are being replaced by 12-hour parking signs, are being replaced by no parking signs, based on the prejudice, the bigotry, and some genuine concerns in the community. If there are concerns, as Mark Adato told me earlier today, about littering, arson, vandalism, and burglary, those are legitimate concerns. But are you going to tar an entire class of people, 1,500 to 2,000 of whom will be sleeping outside tonight with no shelter, because there's only shelter in your emergency services for 39 people? Are they going to bear the brunt of this because of the concerns and fears of the Business Association on the West Side? Now, I think to ask this question is to answer it with this council. But one always hopes that somewhere in this council there beats a heart that wants to say, let's examine this a little more closely. Let's look at the police documentation. How many robberies, assaults, arsons, et cetera, have actually been tracked down to people in vehicles? Or are there are main suspects? No documentation is provided with any of this on this item. So I would just ask you, consider first the documentation, ask first for the documentation, put it off for a couple of weeks, inform the homeless service providers, and then if you must, come back and pass it by unanimous vote, as you surely will. But at least give us the respect of at least some kind of real hearing and real investigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dietrich.
Hi, my name is Steve Dietrich, and I'm a business owner in the West Side. First of all, I'd like to thank you for considering this proposal here. I think it's unfortunate that there are people that think this is a homeless issue. Frankly, from our perspective, this is a situation that has been ongoing for a number of years that is a health, a safety, and just an ongoing problem. One of the reasons this came about was primarily budget restraints that we understand the city had to cut back on their available police. And as it stands right now, my understanding is that there are at least two ordinances that are already enacted, one of which is the 72-hour parking, and the other of which is the no sleeping over camping overnight. So what we tried to do here is come up with a consensus of a proposal that would meet the needs of the people that got together and came up with the money to fund this. What we have is a situation where people park for extended periods of time. The city can't come out and tag and follow up and whatnot in a timely manner because of budget restraints. And we are faced with having to do business, if you will, restricted in the streets, sometimes having to unload in the streets because we can't back the trucks into our own driveways. We have situations where our employees do not have a place to park or have to park blocks away because of vehicles that have sat for a long time. We also, I might add, have businesses that have violated this, that they use the street for their storage facilities. So this is something that is across the board, hopefully a remedy for not everybody's problems, everybody's needs, but a remedy to an ongoing problem that possibly will alleviate not only our problems, but enable the city to better use their resources for other issues that maybe some of which have just been addressed. However, I hope that you will give this your consideration. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
And there's more public testimony to come. This is from the City Council of a week and a half ago, actually. I'm pausing here because I believe there's an incoming call due to come in pretty quickly from the Huff Cable down at Pacific and Cooper Streets next to Borders Bookstore. Remember, don't buy at Borders, but definitely read there. Not a bad library, but not so good as a place to buy from. Anyway, some of the things that this speaker, Mr. Dietrich, I believe his name is, has said are really kind of incomprehensible to me. I mean, he's saying partially that, well, there are safety and health concerns, but he's not saying what they are. He's claiming there have been lots of problems, but he's not documenting any of them. He's talking about a cost of people, of police forces going out to use the 72-hour rule or to use the sleeping ban, but he's not talking, not documenting any of that or even the number of complaints that have come in. So it's all simply pretty vague. And it really needs to be, you know, if you're going to eliminate a whole series of streets where people can legally park simply on the fears of people who are business owners without any kind of documentation, well, I mean, it's pretty much a form of straight bigotry as far as I'm concerned, and a serious hardship on people who have no legal place to go. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Uncle Robert here.
Hey, Robert, it's Tom here. I have the person that is willing to talk if you'd like to hear them now.
Well, I hope he's not parked at a no parking sign.
Here you go.
Okay.
Robert. Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, your name is?
I'm Robert. Who are you?
My name is Doug Bird.
Hey, Doug, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Say hello to everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Hey there, Doug.
Yeah, I've been up here from Santa Barbara for 10 weeks. I moved up here ago, and the situation up here is pretty much like it is in Santa Barbara, although in Santa Barbara they've started a thing called restorative justice or restorative policing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're keeping track of what the homeless are doing as far as trying to help themselves and arrest and this and that, you know, and I don't know what they're doing up here, if anything, for the homeless.
I mean, Doug, are you yourself homeless?
Not at this point, but I've been homeless for 3 years.
Down in Santa Barbara?
Yes.
When did you get housing down there, or did you?
No, I lived in the Salvation Army for the last year down there, so actually you could say I was homeless.
Uh-huh.
Because the Salvation Army is just hospitality house, so I really didn't have a place to live down there either.
Well, we had an interview from a talk with Glenn Maurer, former public defender of Santa Barbara. You may have heard of him.
Uh-huh.
And he's been defending homeless people in Santa Barbara from camping and sleeping tickets, but these have largely been replaced by parking tickets. We're finding the same phenomenon up here, where they don't want to give you even the dignity of a non-jury trial in front of a judge or a commissioner. They want to put you in front of a cop or an administrative officer, and you have to pay a parking fine or else eventually surrender your vehicle without any kind of real trial. Are you finding there's a sort of a similar attack on people in their vehicles down in Santa Barbara?
Oh, surely, yeah. The RVs have been, they've made the street laws in such a bad state that a lot of people I knew the RVs have been taken away from them, and of course, a lot of those people being on Social Security or jobless, it's impossible for them to get their cars or their RVs back. Consequently, that's the only option they have is to sleep outside. And to me, it's just total injustice is what it is. I've always thought they should open up a camping facility for the homeless people with security and restrooms, and, you know, it would pretty much help the problem immensely.
Well, yeah, at least as some sort of emergency measure or interim measure. I mean, you need housing, you need better facilities, and, you know, you need an opportunity for people to get employment and so forth. But until that happens, you want to have some minimal facilities where people can at least sleep legally.
Yeah, and even the homeless shelter that was ran by Catholic Charities down in Santa Barbara, they used to use the armory, but, of course, it was only open 3 months out of the year, and that doesn't help anybody. Even if you can get things a little bit situated in 3 or 4 months, if you're back out on the street again, it's impossible to get anything together that's, you know, that'll help you live for any length of time like a proper person. So,
well, here the situation is, you know, similar. The armory, I think, is open from November to April, and then you have the other 7 months of the year or whatever. You have a, you know, 39 spaces on church floors or in a rotating basis in the so-called Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which, you know, deals with about 5% of the need. The rest of the people face sleeping tickets, camping tickets, or parking violations now.
Yeah, well, I don't understand is why they should give out tickets and take people's vehicles away when the people can't even afford to live in the first place. You know, it's going to be impossible for them to pay or do community service in any way.
Doug, they don't want your kind around here.
No, I know they don't. Right now, I live in a clean and sober living environment, and I want to get a thing going up here called Recovery Network, which helps the community know what the recovery world is doing, and hopefully help the homeless at the same time, too, in one way or another, because there's a lot of homeless that naturally abuse drugs and alcohol because they have virtually nothing to live for, you know, so... It's a really bad cycle they have. I look at it as the government. A lot of the government's fault. You know. Personally.
What about Doug? What about activism? I mean, I know in Santa Barbara there was a lot of activism in the 80s and some activism in the 90s.
There were.
And then even around the end of the 90s, you had Peter Maron and Glenn Maurer and other activists, Nancy McCready and others coming together down there to try to get some kind of at least legal places to park, you know, like a, I don't know what you can call it, a campground, a parking lot, for God's sake.
Yeah, church parking lots, and, you know, even a lot of the churches declined, which it's hard for me to understand because I've been a Christian for 34 years, and I would think, you know, the Christian world at least would want to open up their parking lots.
What about homeless people? I mean, you know, blacks got together, Latinos got together, gays got together, women got together, disabled people got together, transgender people got together. Can't homeless people get together and say no more?
I would imagine there would be a way to do that. I don't know what exactly it would take and how it would go about it, but it would take a lot of organization and, you know... a command post type situation to try to pull people together all in one area for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you make of Santa Cruz? You've been up here for, what, you say 10 weeks now? Or?
Yes. It's real similar to Santa Barbara to me, but it has basically all the same problems, but it's all in a more condensed area than Santa Barbara. And there's not as many business opportunities up here for people like that are in Santa Barbara. Particularly, you have Silicon Valley up here. You don't have a whole lot of industry. It just makes it real hard as far as trying to get a job.
Well, Doug, thanks for the update on how things were going down there for the, you know, folks in the same situation. I'm going to play the rest of this tape now from the city council meeting about their latest attack on homeless people and, you know,
okay.
And where it's going.
Okay, well, God bless you, and thank you for your work.
Hey, thank you for helping out here.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, so here again is the city council's, this is still a public testimony period, people supporting the idea of putting up 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. no parking signs paid for by the merchants but enforced by the city police and the city parking authority.
Very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ms. Overbeck?
Hi, I'm Peggy Overbeck. My husband and I have owned a business on the west side of Santa Cruz for over 25 years. We are concerned about commerce in Santa Cruz, especially in an industrial area. And part of that is vehicles blocking entrances or egress. That's one reason we came up with this idea of the parking. There were health and safety issues that are also that we've had to address as business owners. And I'm sure you are all aware of what's going on the west side of Santa Cruz. Thank you.
Thank you.
And there you have it. It's kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod situation where the so-called blocking vehicles has nothing to do with making block after block where people had previously been able to park their van, no parking zones. It's obviously an anti-homeless law, and they don't want to say so. And so they're doing this, you know what's going on there, and we both know what's going on, so it's health and safety, but they're not providing any kind of documentation. I would imagine that there might be some justification if they actually provided documentation. I mean, you know, if people are setting up camp in unsafe ways, if people's vehicles are actually causing accidents, if there you can actually give any documented examples of regular blockage of driveways. But, of course, none of this is available because none of this is what is really going on. What's really going on is a business supine city council, a city council that's willing to bend over for the business community and that couldn't give a damn about homeless people and their rights. And perhaps it's unrealistic to expect them to. After all, the homeless people aren't really a significant voting bloc. Just essentially giving up masses of public space, not just for homeless people, but for anybody who wants to park their vehicle out there. And it's really kind of the giveaway of public space to one special interest group, businesses. And it's completely unjustified. And it's being done with the force of the police behind it. Hence, it's fascist. This attempt, this business commingling of government and kind of behind-the-scenes conspiracy is really the, you know, it's what it is. It's a collusion. It's a conspiracy. It's a combination, which doesn't allow for any meaningful public discussion. They didn't go to homeless service providers and ask them what the consequences of all this would be. They didn't try to look to alleviate the deleterious effects or the collateral damage, if you will. None of that was even considered. They simply left it in the hands of Public Works Czar, Public Parking Director Czar, Matt Farrell, in the Public Works Department, to do whatever he wanted. And their only problem was the budget. They didn't want to spend the money on the signs, so the businesses are going to pay for it. So in essence, what we got is the business writing the laws, the downtown ordinances, the business paying, you know, essentially pressuring the city last time to pay for making more and more spaces unusable for the public because some businesses don't want people to be there, to wit, the Pacific Trading Company doesn't want musicians like Cosmic Chris playing outside their area there. And so they moved the railing of the fence, which had previously allowed for seating of, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 people, so that no one can legally sit on one of the four planters left, which had previously been used for seating downtown. And the same thing happened around New Leaf Market. And we have an interloper here, Dangerous John, who's been keeping an eye on the board in the chat room, who wishes to make a comment. I think we've got to allow him to do that.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick comment about the fact that I believe it's actually illegal to park your car in such a way that it blocks a driveway. So I don't understand why they can't just give someone a ticket for blocking a driveway if that's what they want to do, if they want to enforce the parking rules rather than putting up no parking signs. It seems kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, You know, there's no testimony from the police department or the parking authority that they don't have the money to cover all the thousands of calls they're getting about vehicles blocking driveways or abandoned vehicles or vehicles parked longer than 72 hours for storage. This is simply, frankly, it seems to me, based on reports I've received from the street, of kind of vigilante groups of residents and merchants going around on the west side, banging on people's doors at 4 o'clock in the morning, doors of their vehicles. This is a part of a continued kind of effort, a police-supported effort, to run poor people out of, essentially out of town. I mean, you can say he's running them out of this area, not in my neighborhood, but these are industrial areas. These aren't areas where there are even residences. So it's pretty sinister to me. And it really requires a response, and I don't know if we're going to actually be able to make a response, but if people have ideas, you need to hear about it. 427-3772. And we'll be taking your calls, but here's some more of that city council meeting and the sterling and informative debate that followed this public testimony.
The council appreciates the fact that private sector has stepped forward to help with the cost of these during time of extreme budget constraints. The item now is before the council, item number 11,
on the city council,
which authorizes staff to accept the grant from the Westside Business Association.
I'd like to move
comments
that.
Or
well, I'd like to move that if there aren't other comments.
I have a comment.
Okay.
In the we don't have a map of the decisions that were made concerning these various streets.
No, they're just listed by name.
No, I understand. I have perfect capacity to go out
Fitzmaurice
and find them all and look at them and look at the situations. We don't. I think it's very important that the city government make the decisions about what restrictions are placed on parking and where, and that we do that in a scrupulous way. It concerns me a little bit that the that this might be somewhat far-reaching in some respects, that it might, I don't know what decision points were reached by the group that came together to decide these things. I'm just, when I saw it, I went to agenda review on Wednesday and saw this item coming forward, and I've been thinking a lot about this item. And I'm a little concerned about the process. I'm very much thankful that citizens want to support signage and all those kinds of things, because the city government needs that kind of support. I'm just very concerned about who decides exactly what is posted and how it's decided. I know we've made a process, and this, I'm thinking it out loud, I'm sorry, but I know we had a process that where we decided, and I think quite realistically, that staff could make these decisions. I'm just not certain exactly how that process went along. So I'm going to vote no on this particular item at this point, though I think there are streets that I would certainly post.
That's Councilmember Fitzmaurice, who has not really distinguished himself for his pro-homeless record, and you notice he doesn't use the H word in his discussion. Who knows? Maybe he's remembering 5 years before, when he was on the council previously, when the Homeless Issues Task Force members loudly objected when just one of these streets was being put forward to be posted with no parking signs. That wasn't even on the council agenda. That was being done behind the scenes by the Public Works Department. People on the Homeless Issues Task Force got wind of it and said, don't do this, and they went to the city council, and the city council passed a resolution which, in essence, supposedly postponed all no parking signs until there was a general transportation plan for the city put forth. Now, I've got to tell you, I haven't really kept current on that particular aspect of this whole situation, and I should, and perhaps I will, as we move along. I hope to, actually. But one street in 1999 being posted that way was considered to be the basis for real hubbub at the city council. Now, 12 streets, and the streets affected are Almar Street, Mission to Ingalls, Almar Street, Rankin to the railroad tracks, Burkett Street, Mission to the end of Burkett, Delaware, Swanton to Swift, Fair, Ingalls to Mission, Garfield Park, North and West Sides, Ingalls, Fair to Almar, except residential frontages, Mission, Burkett to Swift, McPherson, Fair to Swift, Natural Bridges, Mission to Delaware, and Rankin, West Side, Almar to the railroad tracks. So that's what 11 streets being posted. Again, all based on sort of behind-the-scenes investigations by the police department and businesses and funneled through the Public Works Department. And here are council members saying, where's the process? Even he's a little worried about it. This is a guy who I opposed when he ran for re-election in 2002. I'd probably oppose him if he ran again. But he's the only one in this whole group to say, wait a minute, let's look at it again. And that's really what I was asking for. Look at it again, more closely. And they weren't interested.
Councilor Premack, did you have comment?
No, I was going to move the item, but it's an interesting concept because I did not participate in this in the process. I'm still supporting it. I suppose I had the option of participating.
This is Mark Premack.
Well, just so questions raised in the public's mind, according to council policies, the director of Public Works has the authority to designate streets and manage parking on public streets in this way. So if council members want to revisit that, I think that's perfectly appropriate, but this isn't necessarily the time this afternoon. Is there a motion to...
I do.
Second.
Okay, a motion and second from Premack and Rotkin. Councilor Rotkin.
I just make brief comments. There's no question that this has some impact, let's say a significant impact on a small number of homeless folks. But, you know, that still makes it a significant impact. The reality, however, is I don't think the city of Santa Cruz can afford to be a place, and again, the only place in the United States that basically says it's okay to sleep on our streets. And there's no other city in this country that does that. Not every city has laws that make it illegal. Lots of cities just enforce it informally. The police drive people out of town without the benefit of actual ordinances, but no one has successfully shown me an example of to the contrary of a city in the United States that lets people sleep on their streets. I continue to believe that we need more homeless services and places for homeless people to sleep, and I continue to and it's, you know, it may seem hollow to some folks, but it's an honest statement. I'm prepared to support an organized campground of some kind or car park or something else if someone can find a place where someone's willing to do it and it's structured in a way that doesn't spill over to affect nearby properties. That's the problem, for example, with the Emmeline Street proposal. The county could decide to let people sleep there, but you know, that would be up to them. It's their parking lot, not ours. But unless it's an organized program rather than just, you know, let people drive up and park, as soon as that parking lot gets filled up, which it surely will, as it has in every other city where they've tried this, the neighbors nearby, which become our problem, start to have spillover into their neighborhood streets of people parking where they're not and sleeping overnight where they don't have any provisions for it. So the idea that we're just going to let people sleep without an organized program on the streets of Santa Cruz is simply unacceptable to me and I think to the city as a whole. As far as Tim's comments...
And just a few interjections here, because Mike Rotkin raises a number of issues, and often very quickly. It's important to kind of grab them before they kind of slip away. His claim that he'd be interested in an organized program is really kind of hard to believe, because organized programs have been presented to him before, and he's fundamentally rejected them. He says that repeatedly, because I think he may even believe it himself. Who knows? But in 1996, an organized program was presented to him involving funding for the city parks. It was initially accepted, and then when pressure came to bear, he quickly retreated. Proposal for the a safe haven for the homeless in November of 1996, presented by Frank Pusilek of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, was not accepted by him. The safe sleeping zones proposal of 2000, proposed by four city council members, was not accepted. In fact, was badly attacked and smeared by him, using the kinds of hyperbole that inflame public opinion, like millions of people are going to come to Santa Cruz. And his claim that there's a magnet effect by allowing people even, he's not even talking about letting people sleep, we're talking about letting people park vehicles. it's not enough to go after people who are parking their vehicles and then slipping away somewhere else to sleep. You're going to make sure that they have no place to even park their homes. So you're going to make sure, as at Lighthouse Field has also been made sure, this is another aspect of this whole homeless disappearance elimination campaign, this homeless cleansing, this social cleansing campaign. At Lighthouse Field, you may remember, the parking lots have been restriped so that vans can't park there during the day. They made the strips narrower. And there's this general attempt to eliminate rights of people through kind of using parking ordinances, which it's not only slimy, but it also has an impact on the rest of the community, because, of course, it's like going after homeless people downtown by using the downtown ordinances. You don't want to have homeless people hanging around downtown, at least some merchants don't. And so what they do is they set up these laws to make it illegal to sit within 14 feet of a building, or to peacefully ask for spare change within 14 feet of a building, or to set up a display device within 10 feet of a building, which makes it, of course, illegal to essentially do any of these things on most sidewalks in any business, any other business district in town. And the Pacific Avenue cuts the space back to about 5 to 15% of what it was, cramming everybody into small zones. And so what's really happening here is people who are, for example, so-called legitimate performers or political tablers also get impacted by these laws. But Rotkin and Kennedy then say, oh, well, the police can ignore the good people. They'll just go after the bad people. And what you're doing here, of course, is police state stuff. You're saying, we aren't going to designate under law what's a standard for everyone. We're going to let the police make decisions on their own as to who will have the right to be in public spaces and who will not. These are fascist mentalities and modes of behavior. They're police state modes of mentalities. That is what we are in the midst of here. And I can't urge strongly enough that we need to fight this. So let's hear a little bit more of the City Council discussion, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. And by then we'll almost be out of time. So if you want to call in, 427-3772 is the number to call.
Be different if somehow I think you raised this interesting point, but if this was being imposed on us or something, but it's already illegal for people to camp overnight on these streets. This just creates another enforcement tool for the police. So I don't think that we've sort of done something.
Enforcement tool for the police. This is the same language Rotkin used in supporting the downtown ordinances. So what you're doing is you're eliminating all kinds of rights to public space to give the police an enforcement tool. No parking signs aren't an enforcement tool. No parking signs mean no parking at night. That's what no parking signs mean. Does that mean if you're parked in your Mercedes in a no parking zone, it's okay, so you don't need an enforcement tool because no one's sleeping in their Mercedes? This is sophistry. This is bogus reasoning. This is deceptive discussion. This is saying one thing and meaning another.
Maybe I misunderstood.
I don't want to get in dialogue unless I'm...
Anyway, that's why I've seconded the motion and believe it should be supported.
Councilmember Porter?
This is actually just a simple clarification. On page 11, it rather simply says no parking signs, and I'm concerned that that's... I want to make sure that's not exactly what it's going to be. On the next page, on the top of page 11-2, it says no parking 10 p.m. to 6 p.m. And I just want to clarify that we're not talking about signs at all these locations that say no parking.
You know, we're not setting the hours. No, we're just accepting the funds from the Westside Business Association. All right, we have a motion before us. Councilmember Premack.
Well, I just make the observation that I'm aware of a number of vehicles in which people are sleeping on the west side that are on private properties, and the owners allow that to happen. And so my sense is, and it's the same when it comes to our whole camping ordinance, is that we have the capacity in the city to support homeless people sleeping in vehicles and sleeping and camping on private property. And we've never really enumerated just how many opportunities they are, but again, in the end, it boils down to the generosity and the trust of our citizens, and I think that's the most appropriate place to place it. And I think that it's appropriate that we enact these as necessary to give some enforcement potential for situations that become detrimental to local the neighbors and residents and workers in the area. So
actually, the City Council in 2000 passed a resolution by Christopher Crone that specifically directed the city manager and homeless service providers to itemize private property available for homeless shelter, which would include vehicular shelter on private property. This was never done in spite of repeated demands by homeless activists like myself. Even when Crone was mayor, he refused to follow up on it. Furthermore, Rotkin's statement that no city in the country allows homeless people to sleep on its streets. Well, you know, in some sense it may be true in that other laws are enforced to go after homeless people. But there are a number of cities where sleeping bans like the ones that Santa Cruz has have been ruled unconstitutional. These include Portland, Austin, Miami, and by settlement, Atlanta. So his statement that there's no laws like this in other cities is just not true. This is what he's claimed at different times. He's being a little more careful in his language now. He's saying that no city allows this to happen. I don't think that's true either. I think that there are numbers of rural cities that are much more tolerant about these things than Santa Cruz is. But the real question is, again, it's the kind of argument that you would hear in the South in the 40s and 50s. You know, blacks are just not allowed to mix with whites anywhere. Everybody has that restriction, so, you know, we're stuck with it. No, we're not. We are a city that's supposed to be progressive and forward-looking. We're supposed to be concerned with basic human rights. This is wrong, and we need to change it. We need to change it here. And if there are problems, we need to work it out. But we don't need to use the private agenda and prejudices of the business community or bigoted residents, bigoted and frightened residents, to essentially criminalize a class of people who need at least the opportunity to be able to shelter themselves legally somewhere, many of whom are Santa Cruz residents, come from Santa Cruz, or have lived here for long periods of time.
This is on the west side to fund the parking signage. We're not making a decision on the signage per se. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Passes 6-1 with Councilmember Fitzmaurice opposed. Next time is number 18.
And that was that at the city council meeting of July 13th. It was Tuesday the 13th. Well, interestingly enough, Dan White did a quite a long story on this issue. Took up about a third of a page in the Monday Sentinel. He added a couple of additional details that there are 120 new city signs involved at this business group, the West Side Alliance, I guess it's called, paid $10,775 for the signs, and that some of this gobbledygook they were talking about was, according to Matt Farrell of the city parking director, or czar as I called him, the city didn't have the money to enforce 12-hour storage rules and no sleeping, no camping laws that are currently enforced in the city. So instead they're just going to not let anybody park there, and it's easier because if it says no parking, people won't park there, and if they do, they can immediately be ticketed, whereas if a person is got a vehicle there, you have to come back and mark it and come back and see if they're there still. And if you're camping, you have to prove they're camping or sleeping. Makes it easier as a, quote, enforcement tool for the police. So, interestingly enough, Dan White quotes Becky Johnson at length in this article, which He gives her three paragraphs. He gives Rotkin two paragraphs. He gives Steve Dietrich of Dietrich Ironworks for all you protesters. Maybe it's time to pack up your protest signs and head for Dietrich Ironworks. Ask them, you know, look at their own health and safety record, because they're talking about this being a health and safety issue. I'm sure the health and safety of homeless people is greatly increased by eliminating one of the few places they have to park their vehicles. It's, of course, bullshit. And interestingly enough, it's not quite exactly the same issue, but in Loose Screws in today's Good Times, there was on page 7, unexpectedly, I found an email that I wrote and that I guess Becky Johnson sent to Councilmember Mike Rotkin on the Santa Cruz City Council, requesting information on the gentrification practices downtown to get some specifics as to how much it's costing, who's making the decisions to put up these fences, these railings, to remove the benches, where all the pressure is coming from, where all the money is going, and what's the process by which it's all happening. Mike Rotkin, at a city council meeting a month ago, unexpectedly offered to answer questions that were emailed to him. So I emailed him this set of questions that were, and I'm going to read some of them, at the June 22, 2004 City Council meeting regarding the funding for the City of Santa Cruz Redevelopment Agency. I asked a number of questions Vice Mayor Rotkin was unable to deduce from the materials on the items submitted for public review prior to their appearing on the agenda. He agreed to follow up and answer the questions in writing. One, moving the fence around the planter in front of the Pacific Trading Company, it's staffing through the Redevelopment Agency, but funding from the Police Department. How is this dual agency project managed? Two, how much was spent to remove the old railing, construct the new railing, install it, and paint it? What was the cost for the staffing time the Redevelopment Agency put into it? I understand this money was taken out of the police budget. Is this true? Was the police department ever reimbursed for this railing, which is next to the Pacific Trading Company and done primarily, I guess, at its behest, for this non-police expense? Three, similarly, what was the cumulative cost of fencing off the planter in front of the New Leaf Market? Four, what process was used and what funds were spent to install the change machine in front of Borders Books? That's the machine that essentially criminalizes sitting within 50 feet on in both areas, both directions, and makes it illegal to peacefully panhandle within 50 feet. It's an attack on the gathering place there. What process was used regarding moving the benches in front of Borders? What groups met to make this decision? How much did it cost? Five, what further projects do city agencies have regarding eliminating more public space from the sidewalk by either A, leasing the area to sidewalk cafes, B, removing benches, C, setting up additional sidewalk furniture that permanently removes publicly used space, and D, moving the railing on planters to make them unsittable? Thanks to Mike for publicly volunteering publicly to answer these questions. And I'd also like a full accounting of city attorney's expenses, and I asked for that as well. In the event that Mike is unable to answer these questions fully, please consider this request a Public Records Act request and pass it on to appropriate staff. Signed, Robert Norris. Rotkin replied, not to me, but to Becky, "Becky, these are not the questions that you asked at the public meeting. Had you asked these questions, I would never have agreed to get answers for you. All of these have been answered for you and more than once and over a year ago. This is all a waste of city staff time, to say nothing of mine. I'm not wasting staff time to go back over the dead horse of the Pacific Trading Company planter, nor the one at the New Leaf. The city attorney costs are all in the public city budget. Let me know if you need help reading that. As far as this Public Records Act, I am sure that submitting an email to me is not the way that happens, so you better make sure that someone else is given that request. Mike." And apparently the Good Times found that amusing enough to quote. Now, in fairness, I want to say that even though it wasn't submitted to the city except through this email, somehow it did find its way to the city clerk's office. Maybe Mike Rotkin forwarded it, and I got some response from the Redevelopment Agency, not a particularly satisfactory response, but some response to those questions, which I'm going to be discussing in a future show. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert in the last 4 minutes.
Hello, Robert. This is John.
Hey, John.
Calling back in again. I just listened to part of your show again at the end there.
Speak up, John.
Well, I listened to part of your show there at the end. We were talking about do various cities have anti-homeless laws. You know, do various cities not have anti-homeless laws?
Right.
And I was just thinking of the classic Skid Row in Los Angeles where, I don't know whether cops roused people regularly over there or not, but it seemed like that was almost a designated area in Los Angeles, as far as I was aware of. And also I wanted to point out there was a little bit of activity in the chat room after I left. Becky, or Woman of Steel, came in and made a comment about something.
So
talking about a particular business over in the west side or something.
Mm-hmm. So your question is?
That was basically my comment.
Okay, good enough.
I also wanted to remind people about the Human Rights Organization meets on Saturday at 3:30 p.m. now at the Loudon Nelson Park behind Loudon Nelson Center.
3:30 Saturday, Human Rights Organization, Loudon Nelson Park.
Right.
Sounds good.
Kick out the downtown ordinances. Get rid of the downtown ordinances.
Discussion of the downtown ordinance, actually fighting the downtown ordinances in the sleeping van.
Right.
Sounds better to me.
All right.
Keep it up.
Okay, talk to you later.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
So, check out the Good Times if you want to look at this further. I'm surprised that they actually printed it in such detail. I've never seen such detail, but I'm glad they did. And you can check it out. If you want, you can come on back on Sunday when I'll be back at 9:30. We'll be doing some more of this stuff. I hope to have some more specifics about what little I did get from the city agencies about answering these questions or avoiding answering these questions or providing some semblance of answers. And, hey, join me then or give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF. If you got further comments, questions, or reports you want to make, and I will pass them on to the community. Thank you very much. See you next time.
Don't believe in a civil world. Nobody ever seems to really get hurt. Don't know what it is that keeps me coming here. People living in fear, 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 fear. People living in fear here. Yeah. Sounds are getting louder and the people seem to cower away from all this mess. Don't need no fucking address to feel validated. Don't believe in the civil world. Nobody ever seems to really get hurt. But I do my part to keep it going round. Shit's gonna hit the ground. Living up and going down. Got the who's who, who's trailing you, who's feeling you, who's pointing fingers at you. Though I allude to the fool, truth be told.